Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on producing good food right after this. From the international forecaster U.S. Markets, he says, we're on the verge of the greatest inflationary binge in history. Our perceived wealth is the manifestation of one of the greatest misallocations of created assets, and as such, its existence will have profound ramifications. Our society today, our world society, has inflated expectations based upon financial leverage and useless credit. Our asset inflation and bubbles have created unsound distortions driven by unsound incentives. And due to this, our capitalistic system is in extreme danger. Speculative market dynamics have fueled our economy for many years in spite of our knowledge that previous journeys into this realm have ended in financial tears and at a deplorable social cost. All of the economic revisionism of today will not make the past and our human mistakes go away. Today, like it was in the late 1920s, there is no sound money or credit. We live in a fiat financial structure underpinned with fiat currencies. This unsound monetary backdrop, like before, has created asset inflation, resource misallocations, speculation that will eventually bring about destabilization, unbridled non-productive debt expansion, wealth redistribution, expedited by offshoring and outsourcing, a form of international socialization, and an economic system now riddled with holes. This condition was not only created by the Federal Reserve System of the United States and other central banks' governmental fiscal profligacy, but also a new factor, the advent of electronic money, so to speak, outside of our historic system. Unchecked, non-productive credit expansion is at the heart of contemporary monetary inflation. Inflation that is officially understated by more than 50% in a system devised to deceive not only the public, but professionals as well. Our bubble is the result of credit inflation based upon the expansion of asset and securities-based finance. A system that is fundamentally unsound, a system based on the value of speculative assets, is inherently unstable and leads to booms, which we have recently witnessed, and busts like we saw in the stock market of 2000 and 2001. And we're about to experience it again, this time in real estate. We are in the age of Wall Street finance, the engine of global leveraged speculation. Wall Street is ably assisted by the Working Group on Financial Markets, also known as the Plunge Protection Team, and the Federal Reserve System by way of the repo pool. We are in an era where Wall Street successes are moderated and controlled by corporatists in both government and at the Federal Reserve. They are protecting Wall Street's leverage mechanisms by interceding in every market. They have kept the U.S. stock market in a narrow range for almost 3 years to keep it from correcting. A 35-50% market correction would destroy the system. And they are assisted as well by other central banks around the world. Thus, we have Wall Street and the Federal Reserve governing monetary issuance, which gives them free rein to create wealth. This is assisted by a so-called derivative structure. Every time the Federal Reserve announces what it's going to do, it does so slowly to allow Wall Street insiders to take their profits. They did that with interest rates over the past 2 years, and they have begun that process with the yen carry trade today. It is a system designed to protect the wealth of Wall Street insiders and the very rich to the detriment of the American public at large. In almost 2 years, Wall Street profits are up 80%, and they knew well ahead of time what the plan was. Slowly, higher interest rates and massive money and credit expansion simultaneously. This slow elevation of interest rates allowed Wall Street and its clients to adjust their interest rate arbitrages and financial instruments and in their carry trade positions. Instead of normalizing, Wall Street ratcheted up its asset inflation mechanism to garner even greater profits. This is why we have not had a tightening in liquidity beyond that which the Fed and other central banks have done. And at this very moment, despite the condition of our financial system and the performance of gold and silver in a rigged market, they are still expanding. They're expanding the use of overissuance and augmenting even more credit inflation. These acts guarantee hyperinflation. And they, of course, are aided and abetted by the Fed's Sir Alan Greenspan in lowering short-term rates, providing the wherewithal and incentive for the street to boost leveraged bond bets, and as a result, bond yields fell. This allowed the boom to continue and the guaranteed profits to flow to the street. But unfortunately, slowing down the runaway train is not working. In order to keep the system from deflating, M3 and credit had to be increased. To terminate or to slow it down would guarantee a financial collapse. So, the high-powered game continues, and any sane person knows the results are going to be disastrous. Understanding this problem is simple, and the solution is there is no way out. Wall Street understands that what they are facing, and they'll play their hand until the bitter end, hoping that they survive. We're now witnessing one of the greatest destabilizing speculative periods in the history of the world. We are going to reap the consequences of unsound money and credit policy. And your only investment alternative is gold and silver-related assets. And this is the only mechanism for protecting your wealth. So much from the International Forecaster. Now, last time we were talking about this thing of the bird flu, the H5N1 bird flu. So stand by. One more message, and we'll be on it again. You know, biotech beans, chemical corn, frankenfish, and the pesticide potato, that's what's on the menu down at your local neighborhood supermarket. And we are concerned that this technology is a serious threat to your health and to traditionally bred open-pollinated seeds. We think that it's a threat to the environment and to the farmers that grow these seeds, these foods. Now listen to this quotation from the Chicago Tribune, which said, quote, "We are being exposed to one of the largest uncontrolled experiments in history. In less than 5 years, these multinational corporations have flooded the marketplace with thousands of untested and unlabeled products containing foreign genetic material," These genetically modified organisms pose several real dangers because they have been engineered to create novel proteins that retard spoilage, produce their own pesticides against insects, or allow the plants to tolerate larger and larger doses of weed killers. Unquote. And you know what's really scary? Is that this isn't from one of Tom Clancy's latest thrillers. These seeds are already a major part of the U.S. corn and soybean crops. So what happens if one of these so-called suicide genes, which prevent seed saving, goes haywire? And say it destroys the entire U.S. corn crop? Or what if it turns out that genetically modified rice kills people? Or what if it causes genetic mutations or birth defects in people like thalidomide did back in the 1950s? Well, personally, I don't want to take that risk, and I don't want to be a guinea pig in this ill-advised experiment. And I'm just betting that you don't either. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, and it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, my $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less class is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and then send an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we've been talking about H5N1. You know, that's the famous avian bird flu. And from a publication called Grain, you can get a copy of it yourself off the web. It's free, www.grain.org. It's easy. It's just grain.org. Click on, see if you, 16-page report, and see if you don't agree that, in all probability, this bird flu is being caused by the factory farms, not by wild birds. Now, there are lessons to be learned from Newcastle disease as it relates to the poultry business. Oddly, in all of the discussion of this bird flu, there's very little reference to parallel experiences with other bird diseases. Newcastle disease, for example, has already become endemic in most poultry farming areas, and vaccination against the disease is now the routine activity for poultry farmers around the world. And like bird flu, Newcastle comes in mild and highly pathogenic forms. In its endemic form, Newcastle is not any big worry. It typically kills a few baby chicks out of an infected flock and only occasionally results in large die-offs when birds are susceptible. The virus becomes a major problem when it enters into factory farms. And according to researchers Alders and Spradbrow, in large commercial poultry units, these mega units, these factory farms, the virus enters flocks through some break in biological security, either on food, people, eggs, or vehicles, by the introduction of infected birds in multi-age farms, or by aerosol, that is, from the air, from an adjoining property. Now, once a few birds are infected, spread within the flock will be mainly by aerosol. Large flocks will produce copious quantities of aerosol virus, which can spread with movements of air to other flocks. It is within this context that the disease can mutate into a highly pathogenic form and wipe out entire flocks. An Australian outbreak back in 1998, for instance, killed 10,000 chickens and led to the slaughter of another 100,000. The outbreak took authorities by surprise, as tight quarantine controls had seemingly kept the country free of highly pathogenic strains for more than 60 years. So we had assumed that it had been brought in from overseas, said Jeff Fairbrother. He's the executive director of the Australian Chicken Meat Federation. However, later research by virologists showed that the outbreak occurred when an endemic strain of the virus entered into a factory farm and then mutated into a virulent form. The Australian authorities didn't respond by going after backyard flocks or wild birds potentially carrying Newcastle disease, and they didn't just accept industry claims about the biosecurity of their operations. They made vaccination mandatory for farms with over 500 birds. And what about backyard flocks? Were they also subjected to mandatory vaccination? According to the government's information brochure on the disease outbreak, the answer is a resounding no. A very mild form of Newcastle disease virus is present in all states. Providing that strain does not mutate into something more virulent, it poses no threat to birds. The outbreaks that we had on the mainland between 1998 and 2002 were caused by a mutation of the endemic mild strain known as the V4 virus into a virulent strain of the virus. All of the available evidence indicates that for such a mutation to occur, it needs a large number of birds in a small area to generate the virus mutation process. In simple terms, a small number of birds cannot generate enough virus for the mutation process to occur. All right, let me read that one to you again. So let's understand something. In simple terms, a small number of birds cannot generate enough of the virus, even if they're infected, for the mutation process to occur. That occurs in these huge factory farms, where there are large concentrations of birds. Now, we call that monoculture. Monoculture. Monoculture throughout history has been explained to us in the most detrimental terms. When I was in ag school, they told us very plainly that monoculture was the kiss of death. But you see, monoculture has some great advantages in economics. For instance, if we could grow nothing but a particular variety of corn in a large area, then we get what we call in economics a return on scale. For instance, if you have 5 acres of corn, and you have to come in and combine that 5 acres of corn, it costs X number of dollars per acre. It takes so much gasoline, it takes so much labor for this guy to come in with his combine. I remember one time I had 7 acres of wheat, and I needed a custom harvester to come in and harvest it for me. And I had to pay this guy a bonus, and I had to wait until the end of the season for this guy to come over and dink around with 7 crummy acres. Now, that same guy sitting on that same combine could go out and do 70 acres. He would rather go out and do 700 acres. God, it would even be better for that guy on the combine if he could do 7,000 acres. Or 70,000 acres, because you see, the economy of scale is there. Hell, we'll get 2 combines, we'll get 4 combines or 8 combines. But when we do this, we introduce monoculture. So instead of having 100 guys with 5 acres, all planting different varieties of corn, so that if some bug gets into a particular variety, it dies out after 5 acres, because there's a different variety of corn. Or better yet, when you get out into a natural forest, and you get a particular insect after an oak tree or after a sycamore tree. So they attack one sycamore tree. I remember down here we had a some kind of a bug come through. I've forgotten what the name of it is now. Every once in a while it comes through. Just kills every oak tree. And they go through in a swath. And I remember they came through our place here, and there's a strip about, I don't know, maybe a quarter of a mile wide, you know, 1,300 feet wide. For about, I'd say probably half a mile. And you killed every oak tree. I mean, these bugs, they go from tree to tree to tree, and they just kill every tree. Just the oaks. They don't kill the sycamore trees or the cedar trees. See, they don't wipe out the whole forest. They just wipe out the oak trees. And then when the oak trees die out, which they ultimately do, as you go through the topography, you'll come to a rocky area where there's no oak trees. There's only cedars and other trees, small brush. And so these bugs, they die. They eat, and then they starve to death, and they die out, and they don't go any further. That's the natural methodology that God has put into the ecology or the ecosystem to stop the virulent spread of insects and pests or disease. Now, when you get into an area like the southern United States where they grow pine trees, they have this problem because that's all they grow down there is pine trees, and so they'll log off 80 acres and then they'll come back in and they'll reseed that 80 acres with all pine trees. And then you get the pine borer beetle, or you get some bug comes through there, and my God, then they got to come in with airplanes and spray everything, and they got to use various toxic chemicals, you know, to knock out these bugs. And there's a natural process that goes on all around us if we just pay attention. A fellow wrote a book called Plowman's Folly back in 1943, and he pointed out that there's no drought in the forest. The drought is out on the farmland. There's no drought in the fence rows. The drought is out there on the farmland where you farm it. Where you interfere with, when you disrupt the natural processes, and that's what these factory farms do. That's what feedlots do. Feedlots are not normal, and they're not natural. And they spread disease. So to prevent disease, we put antibiotics into the animal feed. Yeah, we put the antibiotics right into the animal's feed. So when we go through and we feed not just 5 or 10, like on my little farm here, you know, I have a little flock of sheep, and I have a few cows, about 20 cows. And I take care of my little flock of sheep, 30 sheep, and my little flock of cows, or my little herd of cows. And I don't have to feed those cows any particular rations and antibiotics and chemicals and one thing and another, because they're in a natural environment. But boy, when you start putting those cows in with thousands and thousands of other cows, just like people, just like rats, it promotes disease. So we find that in the big cities, where people are crowded together, and God made an observation one time, he says, woe be unto those that build their houses wall to wall, or house to house. When people live close together, they're in an atmosphere where they can create more disease. That's why we had infectious diseases, you know, like cholera and tuberculosis back in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s in our big cities. The cities were dirty, and people were eating polluted and dirty food, and they were spreading disease amongst and between themselves because of their close living conditions. You know, you take people, you put them out here in the countryside, and they don't have near as much disease problem. You crowd and coop them up. You take rats, you know, and you put them in close proximity. They begin to become homosexual. You wonder what causes homosexuality. We've discovered that when you feed cats pasteurized or homogenized milk in 4 generations, they become sterile. Do you suppose that humans can or might become sterile after 4 generations? Did you know that 5% of the American public. 5% of American women are sterile. They can't have babies. 5%, that's 1 out of 20. That's quite a proportion. And it seems to be growing. Do you suppose maybe pasteurized milk does the same thing to humans as it does to cats? Do you really want to be a human guinea pig? Do you really think that these factory farms are a great idea? Economically, I don't deny it. They are a wonderful innovation. They are a tremendous economic success. But the ultimate end, and when we read Revelation 6, tells us that the ultimate end of this is death and destruction on a scale that is only biblical in its description. We use the term in biblical proportions. You know, when things get so far out of control that they become insoluble, we call that a biblical famine, a biblical disease, a biblical plague. But you know, when we get down to it, we're causing it ourselves. We humans down here on planet Earth. And after all, it's just human nature. It's vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. Farmers want to make more money, so they want to have more and more cattle, more and more sheep, more and more chickens. A chicken farmer with 10,000 chickens dreams of the day when he'll have 20,000. A farmer with 20,000 chickens dreams of the day when he'll have 40,000. A farmer with 40,000 chickens dreams of the day he'll have 80,000. 160,000, 300, and 600, and a million. And, you know, where does it end? It ends when the size and scope of the operation becomes unmanageable. When disease comes in and wipes it out. And that's what we're beginning to see here. But then we hit Panicsville. When this event transpires, we hit Panicsville like the English did over Blackleg. Let's go out and kill all these cattle. We'll wipe out whole herds. When we find one infected cow in this herd, we'll wipe out the whole herd. My God, we don't treat people that way, or at least we haven't so far, that when we find one person with tuberculosis, we don't go into the community and kill all the people in the village. Well, at least we haven't yet. We tend to, you know, sight in on that one person, isolate that one person. We see this in the Bible. God said to isolate that person. It's called quarantine. Get that sick one out of the bunch. And then monitor the rest. Everyone that gets sick, you put them out here outside the camp. You know, there was a time when we were using more common sense, you know, in the past. Today, the multinational corporations, because of market conditions. Now, because of this bird flu, there's a real problem here with getting people to continue buying this chicken. People don't want to buy chicken. I don't blame them. But it's not the chicken that comes from George Gordon's backyard flock. It's the chicken that's coming out of that Tyson plant. I live here in the Ozarks, and then right around me here, there are big chicken operations. And Tyson comes in, and they build your chicken houses and put you in debt forever and mortgage your land. And they get you to grow chicken for them. And they tell you what kind of feed you're going to feed them. I wouldn't eat that if it was me. I mean, you people in the city don't know anything else, but you might want to think about that organic, range-fed chicken is natural, and it's disease-free, and it's safe. But what they're doing here is that they're identifying these range birds over here as being the cause. That's to eliminate competition. If we can eliminate all of these organic chickens, and we can convince everybody out here that safety is in the factory farm. No, boys and girls, the safety isn't in the factory farm. It's just the other way around. The safety is in biodiversity, not in monoculture. And if you want to grow thousands and thousands of acres of corn in a monoculture environment, or wheat, or etc., all you do is invite various pests, various diseases to come in and attack that monoculture, which then requires that we take some kind of preventive action. Then we've got to have vaccination. Then we've got to have, you know, science come in and save our bacon. Then we've got to spray everything. I live in an environment where I have birds everywhere. In my little bird of paradise location here with my thousands and thousands of birds, which I feed year in and year out, I don't have any insect problems here. Sure, there's insects, but there's no problem with insects because the birds keep the insects under control. But we don't spray here, and because we don't spray here, we don't kill the birds. So when you spray, you kill the birds, so you have to kill the insects. You can either do it with birds or you can do it with spray. And listen, Monsanto wants you to do it with spray. The government wants you to use spray. The government wants factory farms. Tyson wants factory farms. But, boys and girls, is that good for you and I, and is that good for Juan Valdez? So while you're thinking about that one, let me give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard 7 days a week around the world over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite on The Law Hour and editorial review are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by The Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about producing good food. Where does good food come from? Does it come from factory farms? Well, it is the links between backyard production and the industrial poultry system in both directions that are so problematic. You see, backyard farms can act as reservoirs, as the FAO puts it, harboring bird flu beyond the reach of authorities until it eventually finds its way into intensive poultry operations where the disease amplifies and potentially evolves to more highly pathogenic forms with the potential for transmission between humans. Backyard farms are also often intimately connected to the industrial system through markets, inputs such as day-old chicks and feed, and even veterinary services. The opportunity is always there for highly pathogenic bird flu to pass from the industrial system to small-scale poultry farms or vice versa. Now that's the story we get from the United Nations. Now, why is Laos an exception? Well, the principal reason as to why Laos has not suffered widespread bird flu outbreaks like its neighbors is that there is almost no contact between its small-scale poultry farms, which produce nearly all of the domestic poultry supply, and its commercial operations, which are integrated with foreign poultry companies, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The poultry industry in Laos is predominantly one of small holders, raising free-range local chicken breeds nearby their dwellings for meat and eggs, mostly consumed by the household or sold locally for income. An average village has around 350 chickens, ducks, turkeys, and quail being raised in small flocks interspersed among village homes by about 78 families, with women primarily responsible for the ducks, turkeys, and quail that are raised, with negligible amounts of geese found scattered around the country. The few commercial operations, less than 100 total, with 89 of these located near Vientiane in the country supply nearby metropolitan areas, biosecurity and technology utilization are minimal, with little available veterinary care from either private or government sources. All right, so here's what you've got in Laos. You've got some factory farms, but you don't have near as many as you have in Thailand, Vietnam, and China. You have a lot of little small flocks. If bird flu were endemic in these small flocks, then it should be spreading from small flock to small flock all over the countryside. But it's not. What's happening is it occurs in these factory farms. And then the factory farm owners, in their attempt to divert from the marketplace, the fact that it is these factory farms that produce this killer flu, point their fingers over here at the little flock guy and say, this is the cause of our problem. His little flocks are getting the bird flu from the wild birds. It's just survival of the fittest. I mean, think of it. If the people ever find out that these diseases are coming from these factory farms, they're not going to want to buy the product. It's already a problem. People have stopped buying chicken. They are so paranoid. They're so fearful now of chicken. In some areas, people have just stopped buying chicken. It's off by 80% in places like France. I mean, and you know, these big factory farms, you know, have to sell that chicken. So I guess they'll ship it over to the United States. And then McDonald's and with their McNugget burgers or whatever it is that they're selling and Colonel Chicken will have to get their chicken from some other source, won't they? But they don't want to buy that local source chicken over in France. Now, the truth of the matter is, it's not coming from the little flocks, boys and girls. It's coming from these factory farms. It's coming from monoculture. It's coming from what all of us in agriculture know. And we have been taught and we have been preaching that monoculture is the kiss of death. It disrupts the natural processes. So we have to interfere then in the feed by putting in antibiotics. Boys and girls, if I want to buy antibiotics, I want to go to my local doctor and pay him money and buy antibiotics. I don't want to be eating antibiotics in my chicken. I don't want to be eating 28 chemicals that come out of those factories that produce that chicken. I'd rather buy my chicken from some little guy over here who's letting his chicken eat bugs and worms and a little grain, and it's natural and it's organic. Now, that's just me. Well, in other words, Laos is rife with free-ranging chickens mixing with ducks, quail, turkeys, and wild birds. There are predominantly native chickens, which account for 90% of Laos' total poultry production. If free-range farming and migratory birds are responsible for spreading bird flu, we should expect to find the disease raging across that country, Laos. This has not happened. In fact, the country's backyard farms have barely been touched. Well, then how come we're after all the backyard flocks in Sweden, Italy, Austria? Fear. Fear and the news media. See, the news media is controlled by government. And news media does not publish, does not print that which isn't approved, which isn't politically correct. And when government comes up with a policy, and the policy is factory farms, and we want to eliminate competition. Let me tell you how they did it in the oil industry. The big oil companies go out and drill holes in the ground, and they produce oil by the tens of thousands of barrels. When Standard Oil is producing oil, they want a well that produces 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 barrels a day. I mean, they want to turn on the spigot and make money. Well, back in the 1940s and 50s, there were a lot of oil wells that had gone dry. Now, oil wells never go dry. They just produce less and less and less until finally a company like ExxonMobil gets an oil well that's producing, let's say, 500 barrels a day, and they say, well, it's economically unproductive. So they sell it off to what they call a tertiary company. Some smaller company that can take 500 barrels a day and take 100 of those oil wells and produce off of those oil wells. And then pretty soon, when that oil well isn't producing 500 barrels a day, it's only producing 5 barrels a day, that company says, well, it's not economically viable anymore, so therefore they sell it off to some stripper operation. Well, these little stripper operations, prior to the onslaught of the big oil companies, were producing 17% of all of the oil in the United States. 17%. You know, pushing on to about one barrel out of every five was coming out of oil wells that were producing 5 barrels a day or less. And then all of the other big operators over here were producing the other 83%. Now, the big oil companies are going on here, and 17% of the oil is being produced by these little outfits. And I had an oil guy in here, a little oil producer. And he said, what happened was, is that when the price of oil got down to $10 a barrel, these 5-barrel-a-day operations became unprofitable. I mean, you know, you couldn't take an oil well that's producing $50 a day and make the thing pay. And so the little guys just closed them down. So the state came in and said, if you've got an oil well that isn't producing, it has to be plugged. So over here in Kansas, they plugged thousands of oil wells that would produce 5 barrels a day, 10 barrels a day, 15 barrels a day. But at $10 a barrel was uneconomical. Now, who was it that went to the state legislature and said, we got to plug these wells? Well, the big oil companies. The lobbyists for the big oil companies came in and said, we need to do this. And they got to come up with a reason. You know, they came up with some reason and said, well, groundwater might get into them and pollute the water supply. They always come up with a reason. as dumb as the reason might be, has the groundwater gone down in those wells over the past 50 years and polluted the groundwater? No. But if these wells aren't producing, now the big oil companies have a financial interest in shutting off that 17% of production, because if that 17% of production is shut off, it makes oil scarcer, and it drives the price up. And it did. And now the price is $60 a barrel. Well, at $60 a barrel, a guy could take those 5 barrels a day, and that would be $300 a day. Now, that's economically viable, except that that well has been capped. It's been plugged. Now you got to redrill it. Well, you can't go out here and spend $100,000 to $300,000 to redrill a well to produce 5 barrels a day. So now it truly is uneconomical. It wasn't when the price is right. It's just uneconomical now that you've plugged them up. So the big oil companies have eliminated 17% of America's domestic supply. That's before Hurricane Katrina wiped out, 27% of our domestic supply. That was before the environmentalists got hot and heavy and said we need to shut down all drilling up here in the in Alaska and so on. Well, let me tell you how that's going to come out. I don't know how much oil is available up in Alaska, but for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, it's in our best interest, boys and girls, for us little guys down here at the bottom to have cheap energy. And there seems to be plenty of cheap energy out there. It's just that there's a monopoly that controls all of that cheap energy. Whereas 50 or 100 years ago, all of that energy was out there in the free marketplace, and anybody that wanted to dig a hole in the ground could dig it out. Today, you have to have an environmental impact statement. That costs $100,000 to $200,000. Boys and girls, by the time you file this environmental impact statement, after you've closed up all of these stripper wells, and it costs you another $200,000 to $300,000 to drill the well, you've taken 17% of your oil and you've locked it up forever. It's gone. But those wells would have produced that 5, 10, 15 barrels a day for some little guy out here. You know, suppose that you're just a truck driver and you went out and you bought 5 of these stripper wells and you were making $300 a day. You know, you could probably make a living on $300 a day, couldn't you? But that makes you a competitor to Standard Oil. And you and thousands of other little oil producers producing 17% of the nation's oil, when it becomes economically infeasible for Standard Oil, means that instead of $60 a barrel oil, we're only going to get $30 a barrel oil. Well, $30 a barrel oil would give you $150 a day off of that well, and 5 of those wells would give you $750 a day. Now, you could probably make it on 5 wells, producing $150 a day at $30 a barrel, which would be about $1 a gallon gas. But Standard Oil wants $2 a gallon gas or $3 a gallon gas, and we need to shut down all the stripper wells, and we need to close off all exploration in Alaska. We don't want to find any more oil. We've got plenty of oil at $60 a barrel coming out of Saudi Arabia and Iran and Kuwait and other places around the world that we've already got developed that produce 10,000 barrels of oil a day per well. And we don't want any competition. All right, now that's what they did in the oil industry. Now that's what's going on in the poultry industry worldwide. This is an assault by using fear of this flu virus. And it's being caused by the very people like ExxonMobil and their lobbyists who lobbied against the little oil wells and closed them down. The reason that the environmentalists and the oil lobby are bedfellows is because companies like Richfield are the biggest suppliers of money to organizations that are environmentalists. The environmental organizations get most of their money from the oil companies. They're kissing cousins. It's a symbiotic relationship, like a pilot fish cleaning a shark's tooth. One can't live without the other. They both work hand in glove. They both work together to accomplish a goal: higher oil prices. Now, in the poultry business, some guy like George Gordon, who has 42 chickens, I got 42 chickens, boys and girls, 4 roosters, and 38 hens. And I produce all of my own chicken and eggs. In fact, there's enough there probably for another one or two other families year-round. Now, that is a competitive force against the egg market. I don't buy eggs in the grocery store. And perhaps two other families don't buy eggs in the grocery store because George Gordon has these 38 laying hens. That's bad. Because, you know, if 1,000 people like me had a little backyard flock of chickens and produced enough eggs for two other families, that would be 3,000 families that aren't buying any eggs out of the grocery store. Can you see the competitive factor? So, the egg lobby, the poultry lobby, the Tyson company, the ADMs, the Cargills, they come along and they say, you know, we prefer having big 100,000 chicken farms because on the economy of scale, it produces cheaper eggs, cheaper meat. But we have 3,000 people over here, 3,000 families with 4 people, that's 12,000 consumers who are not buying eggs from us. We need to close them down. How can we close them down? Can Congress just pass a law and say, we want to close down all little chicken farms because they compete with ADM, Cargill, and Tyson, and therefore, no, that's a property right. So what we have to do is come at this in the interest of the health, safety, and welfare of the public. We have to protect the public health. So we come along with big factory farms which cause H5N1 flu virus. Then we turn it around and we say, my God, it's George Gordon with his 38 laying hens over here that are threatening the entire poultry industry of the world. His chickens are running around loose under the sky, and they can come into contact with hawks who might come down and grab one of those chickens and give it the H5N1 virus. You see, we lay people are just driving trucks and we're running the kids off to soccer practice, and we don't know. We just believe what the hell Dan Rather tells us, or in this case now it's a new guy. What's his name on CBS Evening News now? I'll think of his name here in a minute. You know, the white-haired guy, the old guy. Well, anyway, you know, he gives us the straight skinny, and after all, he's a news reporter, and he gets the copy that comes from somebody, probably from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, who probably got the press release from the legal department of Tyson or Archer Daniels Midland or Cargill. And we believe the propaganda that's being fed to us. That's what the bottom line is. We believe this pseudo-scientific propaganda, which in reality, is just good business on the part of, you know, in the case of the oil companies, it's just good business on the part of the oil companies to shut off that 17% of production. But boys and girls, that 17% would be pretty important in America today, don't you think? I mean, if we could raise the production of oil in this country by 17%, that's nearly 20%. That's pretty significant. Now, up in Alaska, they've got some big oil deposits that they don't want to develop. Now, I don't know exactly how big they are. They say 6 billion barrels. Well, that's a 1-year supply of oil for the United States. If it was 60 billion barrels, it would be a 10-year supply. Now, if we went up there and we actively explored for oil in Alaska, and let's suppose that we found a couple of three more of those Prudhoe Bays, do you know what that would do to the oil price worldwide? It would be a downward pressure. I wouldn't say it's devastating, but it'd be a downward pressure on prices. We don't want that in the oil business, do we? Don't we want, you know, if you're running an oil company like like ExxonMobil, would you rather see $30 a barrel oil or $100 a barrel oil? I mean, let's just be business people. If you've got tar sand up in Alberta, would you rather see $30 a barrel oil or $100 a barrel oil? If you're a Saudi sheik and you're selling oil, would you rather see $30 oil or $100 oil? I mean, the only people in the world that want $30 oil are the consumers. And consumers depend upon competition, free markets. Well, my God, you know, as a businessman, the last thing we want is competition and free markets. That's why old John D. Rockefeller said competition is a sin. Competition is a sin. As a businessman, I want a monopoly. And after all, that's what big pharmaceutical companies have created here in America, a monopoly. So the president went out the other day and he said, we Americans are going to, we're very altruistic people. We're going to spend $15 billion a year fighting AIDS. No. What President Bush is proposing is that we spend $15 billion a year as a subsidy to the pharmaceutical industry at taxpayer expense. So we're going to take $15 billion of your tax dollars and we're going to give it to SmithKline and Merck and Pfizer to buy AIDS drugs to give to people in Africa and Asia so that we can combat AIDS. You got to have a reason for doing this. The reason for doing this is so that if the president said, look, I want to take $15 billion of taxpayer money and give it to the pharmaceutical industry, well, you people would sit out there and vote for the Democratic Party in the next election. So the president has to have a reason. So he comes up and he says, my God, we've got to fight AIDS. We've got to do something for these poor people in Africa. And I'm going to spend $15 billion fighting AIDS in Africa. So the federal government's going to buy the drugs for these people in Africa at full bore retail from the pharmaceutical companies. Which, by the way, Bill Clinton's fighting AIDS, and he discovered that you can fight AIDS by buying the drugs in India for 10 cents on the dollar. The president could get $150 billion worth of AIDS drugs if he'd buy them from India instead of from American pharmaceuticals. So if you Americans want to get more bang for your buck, buy the drugs in India and give it to the poor people in Africa. Well, I'm about out of time here, boys and girls. We've got to leave it right there. We'll be back tomorrow talking about this thing of producing good food and the flu virus, this phony flu story, next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. So the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, 7 days a week worldwide over the Internet also. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. We're out of time. I got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening. Good night, friends.